Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Shauna Craig. Shauna Craig's writing has appeared in several literary magazines and books, including Prairie Schooner, Fourth Genre, Crab Orchard Review, and the flash fiction anthology You Have Time for This, Contemporary American Short Short Stories. She has received awards and honors from the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Vera Heintz Foundation, the Pushcart Prize Anthology, and Best American Essays. A Montana native, she currently lives and teaches creative writing at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Prosody, Shauna.
Thank you.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
That sounds great. This is a flash fiction piece called The Man with the Shovel. The man with the shovel dreamed once of the trapeze. He was a boy then. He'd gone to the circus with his father, a man who would leave. The air flashed bright with red leotards, bodies flipping through space. Someone always caught these bodies with slender hands, slight fingers that could miss or snap off like twigs. But first came the breathless moment, the what if. "What did you like best?" his father asked. The man who would leave was still there then, driving fast in the dark as the boy slumped under his seatbelt, his stomach cramped with cotton candy and warm lemonade. The seatbelt pinched and pulled. He said, "The flying people." "You mean the acrobats? People can't fly." And he nodded, "Yes, the acrobats who lived on air." The man with the shovel is too slow for the one who drives the orange public works truck. He moves slower as the day grows long. The driver honks and swears. They're animals. They're dead. They don't need last rites. The man with the shovel never explains. He scrapes the squirrels from suburban drives, gently balancing them as he steps towards the truck. He knows they've been hit by things they couldn't outrun. Some are flattened. Bloody pelts. But so many of the bodies he lifts are soft and whole. He pretends their toes missed a branch that a tiny twig gave. Maybe their hearts burst from the altitude. Yes, he thinks when he sees no blood. Burst hearts. He launches them from the end of his shovel. They flip in the air, white bellies flashing through sunlight. Flying squirrels. People can't fly. Squirrels limp as those acrobat bodies in the moments before they were caught. Late in the day when the truck bed is full, lined with feathers and fur and the odors of decay, he knows they land safe. The man with the shovel dreamed once of the trapeze. He was a boy then. When the driver backs in and raises the end, broken bodies slide into the pit that yawns like a mouth. Fur and feathers collapse. Squirrels and birds and the cats that chase them nestled now in eternal truce. The man with the shovel waits near the piled earth. All is still, except the delirious flies. All is muted and dirt-dulled, but the guts. They shine red, bright leotards stripped inside out.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Shauna Craig. So I actually requested that you read that piece. And I just find that image so stunning. I mean, in the how you get from acrobats to animal pelts on the side of the road, the idea of bursting hearts, the white bellies in the sunlight. Where did all that come from?
Well, it probably originated that I have sort of an obsession with roadkill. I can be driving with my husband and I notice every dead thing on the side of the road, and he'll see living birds flying off, or he'll point out a deer and I'm focusing on the dead porcupine or whatever. So I've always just noticed them, and I guess I'm sentimental and I always have feelings towards the poor things. But this one actually originated. I was sitting on my porch in Indiana, Pennsylvania, out on the front porch, and I watched an orange public works truck going by. And I saw the man who had a shovel, you know, with his little works thing, and he picks up a squirrel, and there's tons of squirrels in that town, and so they're always getting hit on the road. And he picked it up and just sort of flipped it into the back of the truck. And I just saw that moment. And a couple of things struck me. One, that I never really – I knew somebody picked those up.
Right.
They're gone, you know, after 2 days if you're lucky. But I never really thought that that's somebody's job. Somebody every day has to go around picking up the corpses of animals that have been hit or electrocuted or whatever. And the second thing was just that moment of it flipping. It was autumn, I believe, late afternoon sunlight, which really casts this magic glow on everything anyway. And just seeing it flip and something just kind of linked as that was an acrobatic moment. It was like the squirrel's last, you know, hurrah, as it were. And that just is where it kind of started to coalesce.
And And with your work and in being someone who writes regularly in the very short form, I'm not going to be – is that the one trick to how you can make this happen? I know it's not that. But do you find – does your work start often from an image or
– Yes. It almost always starts from some particular image and then – I let it sit for a while. It's just – and if it's good, I feel like it sticks in my head. And then the rest of the story or the rest of the images or ideas start to sort of coalesce around it.
Right.
So it's almost like that little nut that the shell gets built around it as you're writing. And it's just going to be a little nut. It's not going to turn into the acorn tree that the novel is or that type of thing. So.
Right. Well, would you read a little bit more of your shorter work for us?
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
Great.
This is another short that works in somewhat the same way. This one is called To Taste. The baker's daughter steals her daily bread, tucking rolls and warm crusts in her skirt. She nibbles these as she walks to school some misty mornings. Sourdough is for the sea, for boats to weather any storm and gulls to guide her home. Honeyweed is for the plains, the dirt she would plow, the farmer's wife she would be. The croissants are for Paris, for silver jets and open-air cafes, for the way she will let strangers kiss her. Her pockets, stained with butter, become translucent as the skin of saints. She grows fat on bread, her arms resembling loaves tucked and pinched and rising up out of the pan. Her mother complains, "What boy will love you now?" She moves the butter, hides the cheese, forbids whole milk, and locks up the cakes. The baker's daughter simply smiles, shaking out the telltale crumbs on her return, so the sparrows can imagine their gulls, so the starlings can dive with the red-tailed hawks. One day while she lets Paris melt in her mouth, tasting joie de vivre on her tongue, she steps into a city street and the milk truck can't stop. Her spirit rises like good yeast and a grackle steals the bread that falls cold from her hand. The milkman is horrified, the mother distraught, and the baker throws his starter doughs into the trash. A starving woman rooting for a meal will find it and eat it and feel her stomach expand with cramps for days. The milkman brings to the silent bakery bottles of milk, their necks clogged with cream thick and white as snow. He begs them to taste. His eyes fill with tears, and while the baker turns away to dismantle his mixer, his oven, his life, his wife stretches her finger and takes a small taste. Each day the milkman returns. Each day she drinks more until one morning she gulps a whole bottle and milk spills down her skin and onto her breast, where it stains and sours by nightfall. The baker tells her to throw away that dress that smells like the infant their daughter once was. But his wife wears the dress to bed, and in the morning, when the new milk comes, their bed begins to stink. She grows fat with milk. Her breasts swell and her hips round as they did when she was with child. The milkman sees how lovely she is, milk-fed. He imagines her on his dairy farm, kneading bread and feeding children, lots of plump, healthy children. And because her fingers still remember the roll of dough and her breasts the pull of milk, she leaves with the milkman and buys a new dress, white as cream, silky as flour. They honeymoon in Paris, they make love by the sea, and they raise their babies on whole milk and cheese and buttery croissants. One winter day, when a thin man steals from their trash a crust of bread, he will chew it slowly and recognize the taste. He will imagine he is a sailor facing the salty spray or a farmer cutting the earth. Finally, at night, stirring the molding blankets of his bed under the pier, he will remember that once he baked, once he made everything rise.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Shauna Craig. Shauna, one of the things I noticed in that piece, I think it is an example of it, that your stories have kind of a fable quality to them, and it's I think it's not just about, you know, fables often are seen as, oh, we'll learn some lesson from the end of it. But it's actually, it's a craft choice that you've made in not, it's, you know, it's the baker's wife. It's not, you know,
the man
Vera
with the shovel.
The man with the shovel. They're kind of characterized by their place in the world. And so I just wanted you to talk about that a little bit, like that choice, because it's not one you see that often.
Yeah, and I've actually enjoyed that because it does have a almost fairy tale and, as you said, fable-esque quality to it. And I feel like that allows me to – I don't have to know that person as an individual character to write about them like I would with a longer story or a novel where you certainly get deep into characterization. But it's that glimpse in, and it kind of allows me that distance where they are the baker's wife or the man with the shovel. They have a role in the world. And yet they, like I said, they aren't specific people, so that whatever happens to them and whatever that world embodies, anybody can kind of access that. And like you said, it's not Ed, the man with the shovel. It's not Vera, the woman who does this kind of thing. And it does become kind of a story that I think, you know, there's a long tradition of stories that are meant to not be about specific people, but that allow us to understand larger things going on in the world through these roles.
As a writer, do you find – I mean, obviously, if it's something you're working with, you're comfortable with it. But, you know, there's kind of two sides to that. There's the one side where you're dealing with someone who is more of a has a more kind of iconic feel. You know, here's this person, this working person or this woman. And then on the flip side, you know, for some writers, it's – you know, I know this particular person and that's how I access the world. Are there any particular challenges? Like, has there ever been a time when one of your baker's wives have really wanted to be Vera and you had to say, no, put your name away?
You know, when I think I'm working with the shorter form, and I work in a variety of lengths of form with fiction, but I think with the shorter form, I tend to either do a first person piece that doesn't necessarily have a name, or I really do like The Baker's Daughter, The Man with the Shovel. And part of that is, like, I got the idea for the To Taste piece. I got that first line, I think, as I was walking home from school in my head. And it was the notion that the baker's daughter steals her daily bread. I don't know where the idea popped in, but I immediately was thinking, okay, her role as the baker's daughter, why would she have to steal her daily bread? There should be abundance in that. It should be, you know, accessible. And that's what kind of kicked that off. And so I think her role then as the baker's daughter became very important. And then how the other people played into that. And I think it ultimately, in my mind, becomes a fable or a tale about grief and how we process or respond to grief and abundance versus kind of that tightening in and pulling away from abundance. So in that respect, I think when I'm doing those smaller pieces, I go into sort of a different space where I'm not working with deep character or with somebody's, you know, psychology so much as these stories that what happens, I hope, will speak, like I said, in larger ways. Why would the baker's daughter have to steal her daily bread?
Well, and I think, you know, a way that you expand the pieces that is not necessarily the print on the page has to do with your language choices as well. You, you know, have really lovely her arms were getting big like loaves of bread, I think, or you know, those kind of images and the way that the language expresses. And so, with that, is do you find that that's one of the things that, you know, drives you through it is the language?
I think language is, and I think that's part, you know, when I get a first sentence like the baker's wife, or sorry, the baker's daughter steals her daily bread, it's the rhythm of that. It's every, not only the idea that surrounds it, but I really, the rhythm of things. And I feel like my most lyrical or most poetic voice comes out in these shorter pieces where I'm deliberately playing with how something rhymes against something and how it sort of continues to build that magical feel of the little fable or the story. And I think you're right that language is the greater impulse, whereas when I'm writing something longer, I'm dealing with character, situation, plot in ways that are different. And later I come back in the editing process and language, my attention to that becomes sharpened. But the original impulse, I think language and just hearing the rhythm of it in my head as I write is a major part of the actual drafting of the short short.
Yeah, great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Shauna Craig. Shauna, would you read some more?
Yes, I think I'll read, like, because we've been talking about some of the difference between shorter pieces and longer pieces, I'm going to read an excerpt from a longer story, a fairly new story. The story is called The Good People of Great Falls Welcome You. And the excerpt I'm going to read, I have a main character, Brendan, and this is actually a flashback into an event that has since come to define his life and the current problems in it. It had started as a routine autumn Saturday, early morning weightlifting at the high school, training for football. After, he and Toby went to the 7-Eleven for donuts and gigantic soda pops. Then, as usual, they just drove around in Toby's shiny black Ford F-150 with the Chevy Peon decal and the No Fat Chicks bumper sticker, and his personalized license plate, Bum Ski. Ski Bum, the first choice, was already taken. They'd shoot the breeze, rate the hottest girls at the high school, argue for or against God's existence, or talk about the ski shop they planned to open after college. Toby's dog, Rico Suave, always came along. He barked at anyone who came within 3 feet of the vehicle, and Toby liked to joke that he got the dog to protect the truck. Brendan suspected Toby got both to complete some vision of himself as the ideal Montana man. Tough, expensive truck with a gun rack, though empty, a dog that even friends feared, a starting position on the football team, and the letter jacket to prove it. His senior portraits featured all of his prizes, and he'd wanted Brendan to borrow the dog so they'd match. Brendan's mother had said over her dead body would he pose with a dog, gun, or truck. Why not wear a t-shirt that says I'm a big cheating jerk, she'd asked. There was his long-gone father, still ruining things 11 years later. That day they had their drinks wedged between their thighs, Rico was panting between them, and they'd just exited the highway, back into city limits, when Toby slowed the truck and asked, "Ever wonder what it would be like to run over a person?" It wasn't a crazy statement if you had the context of what happened that summer just before school started. At least that's how Brendan tried to explain it before he stopped explaining. There was a keg party a few miles out of town at a gravel pit. A couple drunk sophomore boys had wandered off to pee, and a carload of junior girls driving the highway in search of the party had come around a curve, no time to stop for Mark Whipple, who'd been pissing on the yellow center line. The driver convinced herself she'd hit a deer, driving on even as her friends screamed and dialed their mothers on their cell phones instead of 911. There had been a school-wide memorial for Mark on the second day of classes, and the driver, hospitalized with a nervous breakdown, was still fresh fodder for gossip. Brendan's response was now a frozen mammoth in his mind, a forever perfect specimen from an era long ago, tested, measured, every angle examined. He said, "You mean like her?" and pointed to the woman jogging on his side of the road a block ahead. 50 points, 20 more if you leave the sign standing. The woman, in a pale pink tracksuit, was approaching one of the welcome signs posted on the perimeter of the city. "The good people of Great Falls welcome you." Every teenager he knew said things like that in a car. 10 points for the guy in the wheelchair, 15 bonus if you can make him do a wheelie. Things like that. Toby had said, "Okay," gunning the engine, and Brendan had laughed. The next thing he knew, the truck was on the sidewalk against a wall of bushes, their leaves tipped orange and yellow. He would always remember how the leaves seemed like tiny matches just struck, ready to consume whatever they touched. Rico was barking, the sound painfully loud in his ears, his pants were soaked, all cold and sticky, and his nose was bleeding, though he couldn't figure out why. He whimpered, wiping his nose along his arm in a sticky red trail. The dog kept up his maniacal barking, and Toby stared straight ahead, the strangest expression on his face, something Brendan had fumbled to describe because he'd never seen such a look before. When the dog settled into a plaintive whine, Brendan heard for the first time persistent, low moaning. It was coming from somewhere under the truck. That was the story he no longer told, because everyone always asked, aloud or not, what he'd done next. He hadn't even called his mother on his cell phone. All he remembered was petting the frantic dog, telling him it would be okay.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Shauna Craig. A lot of death in your work.
There's a lot of death in everybody's work. It's all around all of us all the time.
There is, but that's true. But what I find interesting is that it's just kind of it's just part of the fabric of the story. Where a lot of times other writers will use it as like the event or the particular thing that happens. And so I'm just wondering if you can talk about that a little bit. Can you talk about death?
I can talk about that a little in context, especially of, I guess, the excerpt, but even just more generally. As you think you said in the bio, I'm from Montana, and it's a from a town in town, fairly large town, Great Falls, which is where the story is set. And it's interesting because people who've never been to the state, all they associate with it is it's beautiful, it's pristine, it's all this kind of thing. And of course, I grew up in a town where, you know, 55,000 people, and I remember all these very violent events that happened that were in the news. Stabbings, you know, multiple stabbings and shooting people in the face. Just all these things that I swear everybody else has forgotten. And they, as a kid, they just stuck in my head. And in fact, the excerpt that I just read is based on a story of something that happened there long after I left. I have a friend who's still in Great Falls, and she was describing this event where a couple high school boys had run over, hit a jogger just to see what it was like to hit someone. And apparently, you know, the passenger who's the main character in the story did not know this was going to happen. And, you know, it's another one of those kind of events where I thought, this is just this horrible, horrible thing. And I can't access why somebody like the Toby character would do something like that. That seems so right. beyond me. But I thought, you know, it stuck with me, the idea of this person who is there at the time and is somehow implicated and is trying to, as an adolescent especially, unwind what any of this means or has done. And so I guess I'm someone who does, you know, I watch those shows where a single tooth will, you know, find who the killer is and all that kind of stuff. But I'm really kind of fascinated, not so much death, but sort of more violent moments. And even the squirrels in that Man right. with the Shovel, you know, that's not a natural death. That's a sudden, here you've got this live, you know, cute thing.
Yeah.
The next thing you've got this bloodied pelt on the ground. And I guess so it's really more the violence of that is part of the fabric of things that we either exploit or ignore that I'm –
Well, and I think that's really interesting too. I'm thinking of at the moment actually my father-in-law, who lives in Iowa, and so when he watches the news and sees like you know things that happen in Chicago, he's like, "Oh, that's the violent place."
Right.
Kind of like denying that anything yeah. goes on, you know, in what we has always been depicted as these kind of bucolic, or in terrains like Montana, it's always probably you know the cowboy who got frozen trying to save his cattle or something.
Western
like that.
Version of violence, the sanitized version of violence.
Yeah, and but the idea of really like, you know, it is everywhere all the time
is,
and
yeah,
finding a way to access that.
I mean, the underlying rage that's kind of in a lot of human lives and how that comes out and then how the rest of us have to make sense of that is something that just has always been something of interest to me. So, yeah, I'm realizing I do have a lot of death in my work.
But she's a very nice person.
You wouldn't guess it by looking at me, right?
Could you read a little bit more?
I'm sure. And, of course, the next piece I'm going to read has death in it.
Excellent.
So, try that. This is a short called Gray Dogs. Another dating attempt, City Park, where a goose years ago chased her toddler son, both of them waddling furiously as she laughed. She now waits on a swing, carefully, since she's prone to motion sickness. She has to, but not badly. His station wagon pulls into the gravel lot, the psychology professor she met at a bar, crunch of rock and tire. She stands to wave, and a child darts for her swing. "Hello there," he calls, shutting the driver's door, then opening the back. She imagines a tartan blanket, a plastic sack full of ripe apples, a well-chilled bottle of wine to celebrate the turning leaves. Instead, he gently brings forward into the afternoon sun a stiff wire leash attached to nothing, an empty collar. "It's okay, girl," he says in a tender bedroom voice. "It's just a park. You be a good girl for Daddy." He flicks his wrist and the leash bobbles and surges towards her as if a lively puppy danced there. "She likes you," he says. "She's usually quite shy. Meet my Trixie Jean." She remembers how he snapped the peanuts in the bar and dug out the meat without taking his eyes from hers. How he flicked the shells to the floor so purposefully. How she'd liked that. She looks down through the empty collar at the taupe dirt where a beetle pauses. "Hi, Trixie Jean." The beetle scrambles under a stick, and the collar, baby blue, studded with rhinestones that spray rainbows at her feet, seems to wink at her. He waits, as if she's supposed to reach down and scratch behind the ears, pat the invisible rump, gurgle, "What a good girl, yes, what a good girl." She says, "Should we all take a walk on the river trail?" She keeps her eyes on him, the smile she'd found so instantly attractive. She watches the tiny gap between his bottom teeth expand when he says yes. On the trail, they barely speak. The wind weaves the sun through the trees, and it's as if a thousand black and gold butterflies rise and land in the leaves every second. She wants to tell him this, but he is watching the dog collar wiggle through a hole in the tree, chuckling. "What made you decide to get a dog?" she asks, trying. "The same reasons anyone gets a dog." "Which are?" His wrist falls slack, the collar dips to earth. He says briskly, "I like the companionship." A chipmunk springs past them, but the collar shows no interest. "Why Trixie Jean?" she persists, waiting for revelation. He shrugs. "I almost called her Shadow. She follows me everywhere, and her coat's a lovely deep gray, don't you think?" He holds the leash out so it trembles. The collar keeps winking. Play along, this is only a game. "When I was depressed once," she says, "I mean real depression, I called it the black dog. I didn't invent it, someone famous did. But my son drowned in a boating accident, and that was how I felt, like a big black dog was watching me, like it would never stop stalking, but never attack." She takes a slow breath, and the caller suddenly jumps and strays over to a bush. He says, "The right drugs can make all the difference." Then, "Bad girl." For a moment, it seems he means her, but he is speaking to the caller as it strains to follow something into the undergrowth. How, she wonders, is he sure the dog hasn't already slipped away? The cords of his wrist flex and twist. The wire leash is so stiff that he could never hold his invisible dog in his arms, not with the collar on, never close the way you must hold what you love. "It was a long time ago," she says. "I really have to pee now." She hopes they will head back, but he hands her a crumpled tissue from his pocket. "We won't watch." The professor and his collar dog wander toward the river. She wants to cry, "Watch, you must always watch," but they've vanished. She squats in the dirt alone and relieves the pressure. She remembers how in third grade they'd traced and cut out life-size human bodies, how she'd been teased for pinning the paper bladder between the lungs. But it makes sense to her now, the fill and leak, fill and leak. The wind kicks up, and as she buttons her pants, she stares up where the sky plays hide-and-seek between leaves, where the sun butterflies dance in the treetops until the wind collapses. Somewhere by the river, a child shouts.
Talk to me just a little bit about the discipline of being a flash fiction, short fiction writer. What is it that attracts you to it?
Let me just kind of start with the story, I guess, of how that all sort of started for me. The very first creative writing class I ever took when I was 20, the only assignment we had was to produce a 2-page story every week. Mm. And so I'd never heard of flash fiction. This would have been, 1990 probably, or even earlier. And at the time, I just figured the teacher was lazy and didn't want to respond to a whole lot of work, which may still have been the case. But I remember it just simply forced me to put a story into 2 pages. And then once I left that class and went on to grad school and that type of thing, I was doing regular length stories. And then in graduate school, one of my classmates was sort of specializing in flash fiction. And it came back to me as, oh, this is a legitimate genre. This is something that people do. And I toyed with it a little bit. And it really wasn't until I was teaching full time, teaching 4 classes, that it came back to me, because it was something, as a fiction writer, I could get the impulse of the thing out in a short period of time.
Sure.
Whereas working on a novel, as I'm sure you understand, or long stories, you know, if you don't have the sustained time to work on it, it can slip away from you. And so I really wanted to keep writing, and flash fiction is what said, "I can fit into your day." So that's really how it went.
Yeah, there is an element of writing that's about time management.
Yes, a big element.
And being able to spend, the appropriate amount of time. Well, Shauna, our time, speaking of time management, is up. So thank you so much for coming to Prosody.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.